This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. When Americans think about Mexico and illegal drugs, the story often begins and ends with Mexico's key role in drug trafficking into the United States. Rarely do we think of how Mexicans themselves are suffering from the scourge of drug abuse. Though the data are hard to come by, and historically drug abuse in Mexico seems to have been at much lower rates than in the United States, the problem in Mexico is growing. For example, a 2016 national survey found that 10% of Mexicans had reported having tried an illegal substance, up from 7% in 2011. Moreover, synthetic drugs, the same ones hurting and killing so many people in the United States, are up in Mexico, too. In 2016, 15% of users at government treatment centers sought help for meth addiction. By 2021, that number had soared to 36%. With that rapid growth rate, just as it's difficult to pin down exactly the extent of Mexico's addiction problems, it's also hard to know exactly if there are enough of those government treatment centers that I just mentioned. But there is strong evidence that there are not enough, and not by a long shot. Because in Mexico, a new kind of treatment center is rapidly growing. They're called anexos. They are informal and illegal, and families often send their loved ones there against the person's will. Our guest today has research indicating that there could be anywhere from 5,000 to 10,000 anexos in Mexico City alone. Angela Garcia is an associate professor of anthropology at Stanford University, and her new book is The Way That Leads Among the Lost: Life, Death, and Hope in Mexico City's Anexos. Professor Garcia, welcome to you.
Thank you. Hello.
So first of all, tell us, what exactly is an anexos? How do they get created? Who runs them?
Well, an anexo, which literally translates to annex, is a space, usually one room, that is intended to hold people with addiction problems, much like a rehab clinic in the United States. But these are very rather grim places. They're very small. They're very cramped. They're often located within tenement buildings. So they're often embedded in larger domestic sort of structures. And they're run by lay people who generally have graduated from anexos themselves, having been in them for many years, sort of cycling through, much like the way people in the United States often cycle through rehab. And so they're run by people who have gone through the process of being in an anexo, and who've graduated from being in what they call an anexado, or someone who is there to deal with their addiction problems. And then they graduate to become a counselor. And then eventually they may move on to start their own anexo as a padrino, which translates to godfather and sponsor, or a madrina, godmother. They're very hierarchical in structure, but the people that run anexos don't have professional training. They have the training of having been in anexos themselves, often for many, many years.
Mm, okay. So you follow people in your book, The Way That Leads Amongst the Lost, and one of them in particular is a mother who you have a story about what she experienced right in the opening of the book. Can you tell us about that story?
Yes, her story is like a lot of stories that I encountered while doing my research. She had arranged for her son, who had drug problems and was also a low-level drug dealer in their neighborhood, which was a neighborhood which suffers from a lot of intensifying criminal and neighborhood violence. And Hortensia, as she's named, was very worried about her son, and was her only child. She was very concerned about his safety, as and any mother would be. And so she arranged to have him kidnapped, abducted in a way that she didn't expect it to be quite as brutal as it was. Two men known as servers, as they're called, entered the apartment at a very early hour and beat her son, tied him up, slipped a bag over his head. She was observing the whole event, realized that she had really asked for something to be done, but she hadn't asked for this kind of brutal treatment. And so she wanted to stop the men from doing this. And they basically said to her, back off. If you want this to work, you need to back off. And her son was abducted, taken away, and then eventually released into the annexo that she had arranged for him to be basically a patient at. But she hadn't expected this degree of violence. Mm. And many of the mothers I spoke to who had arranged for their children to be taken to an annexo often also experienced this type of delivery. And the padrinos who I spoke to in annexos, I would ask them, you know, why do you need to pick up people in this manner? And they would say things like, it works. The goal is to instill fear in them so they're not sure where they're going to be taken. It's a practice that in many ways resembles practices that are employed by, you know, narcos, criminals, etc. So it resembles that in some form. But in fact, what people who have been abducted find is that they're released into an annexo and not, you know, further violated or abused outside. So it's a very harrowing experience. And women that have gone through this often wonder, did I do the right thing?
You know, you write in the book, I think that you've also, in fact, yourself have witnessed some of these kidnappings, for a lack of a better word.
I have. I spent a lot of time observing annexos. Yeah. I would spend the entire day just sort of sitting around, talking to people casually. And one afternoon, I was, ready for a day of observation in one annexo, the first one that I started to study. And in came two men carrying what I thought was a rug. And they put the rug down, or what I thought was a rug, and they began to unfurl it. And inside was revealed a young woman who had been also abducted, and she was released from the rug. And I was, you know, deeply disturbed by this because she was clearly in distress. And I went to talk to the padrino shortly after she was released into the annexo. And I said, you know, again, why this terrible act of violence? And, you know, the answer was often, it works. It makes people afraid. Then they come here and they realize they're okay. And they begin to appreciate that much more, the fact that they're alive and haven't been killed or kidnapped and taken somewhere, you know, unknown to them. So this young woman is someone that I followed for several months. Mm-hmm. And she was like, you know, many teenagers, quite young, you know, would like to party, did drugs, but never identified herself as a drug addict, but rather as someone who just did drugs, like, as she would put it, everyone else. But that was enough to bring her into an annexo, not just because her parents were concerned about her drug use, but because they were concerned about her safety. Because at the time, many women around Ceci's age were being kidnapped and abused, and sometimes disappeared. And so this was one way of disappearing her into the annexo, was one way her family felt that they would keep her safe.
Okay. I'd like to come back to periods throughout the rest of the show to hear more about what you learned about Ceci and the mother you also mentioned, who had sent her son to the annexos. But I think it helps... to the annexo, I should say, annexos being the plural. I think it helps to get a little bit more background about why so many of these facilities have been and are opening across Mexico. Because I mentioned earlier that there are government treatment facilities in Mexico. Is it just that those treatment facilities are overcrowded? Are they also financially out of reach of many Mexicans? Why are they not serving this growing population of people who are, and their families who are seeking help?
Both of the factors that you described are one of the reasons why there are so many annexos. There aren't enough treatment services. The ones that are available are often state-run and are known to be in abysmal conditions. A lot of the money that goes to Mexico's mental health care system actually goes to its psychiatric hospitals, which are infamous for being spaces of abuse. So there aren't enough facilities, there aren't enough treatment programs. There are a lot of, you know, private programs for people who can afford them. But the majority of Mexicans are people who work in the informal sector. They're poor, they're working poor, and they can't afford that. Those clinics are out of reach financially. So Anexos really emerged as a response to this lack of professional treatment, lack of resources. And they really stem from communities that are trying to take care of their own. Mm. And they build on a long tradition of mutual aid support networks where you see, you know, essentially poor people kind of creating their own networks of care and assistance. And in many ways, Anexos can be seen in that light as a form of mutual care, mutual aid. Mm. And they really began to proliferate not only with the increase in drug use, but also with the intensification of violence in Mexico. And so that became my primary lens, which was, you know, why are these proliferating in these neighborhoods right now? Why in 2011, when I began this research, were there 10 people in this Anexo? And then in 2018, there were more than 50. Mm-hmm. So what happened? And I was really interested in tracking both the proliferation and then the increase in the population of people who were in Anexos.
You know, from your book, I learned that in terms of the government treatment centers, I think there was in Mexico City, there's something like 65 or thereabouts government treatment centers. But then as you've revealed in your research, there could be anywhere from 5,000 to 10,000 Anexos in Mexico City as well. So clearly there's an urgent need there that's not quite being met, to put it lightly, by those government centers. So when we come back, Professor Garcia, I'd love for you to describe to us more about exactly the kind of treatment that people are receiving in these Anexos. That's what we'll discuss in just a moment. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
You're back with On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and today Angela Garcia joins us. She's a professor of anthropology at Stanford University and author of The Way That Leads Among the Lost: Life, Death, and Hope in Mexico City's Anexos. Professor Garcia, before you take us further into the kind of treatment that people receive in an Anexo, I'm just wondering if you could tell us what got you interested in pursuing this research and really uncovering these informal and illegal treatment centers.
Well, you know, I come from a family that has long suffered from addiction problems. So addiction has always been something that I've thought about, that I've experienced up close. And so it's always been something that has affected me in ways that are more than just, you know, scholarly or intellectual. And my first book, actually, I describe a heroin epidemic in northern New Mexico, which is where I am from. And during that work, during my research, I worked in a detox clinic in the region, which was the only clinic in the area, tending to the needs of detoxing heroin users. And that experience of working with drug users, helping them to essentially kick their habit, to recover, to get through the worst of withdrawals, really got me interested in sort of the experience of addicts themselves. Mm-hmm. And what it is like to be in a treatment center that is in itself struggling to stay alive, and the way that the struggles of a particular neighborhood clinic made recovery that much more difficult for the people that found themselves inside of it. I went to Mexico actually hoping to escape the theme of drugs and addiction, the theme that has sort of in so many ways run my life. And I went to Mexico City hoping to get, you know, to begin a sort of a new project on a theme of a sort of mega development that was going to be taking place in a part of Mexico City. And I was interested in architecture and health and all of these different things. I was trying to get away from the topic of drugs because it exhausted me at this point. But when I got there, I found quite unexpectedly this world of Anexos. And I was immediately drawn into them, as I often am in anything that concerns addiction. And I realized, you know, this is a world where that exists, that is proliferating, and that so few people really know about. I mean, people on the ground know about them, but there was nothing that I could find in scholarly journals. There was very little I could find in the media other than representations of Anexos as being sort of clandestine, hellish spaces where people were deprived of their human rights. But I began to then realize that narrative about Anexos was insufficient. And it just was the narrative of, you know, so many addicts have a very sort of superficial narrative of, you know, what their life is like, what their struggles are like, et cetera. So I knew there was pieces of the story that were being the few pieces of the few stories about Anexos. I knew they were insufficient. And I wanted to go in and understand more fully what these spaces were, how they worked, who was in them, why were they in them? You know, the questions just you know, kept emerging for me. And I found this to be a really an unexpected space from which to try to understand not only addiction in Mexico, but violence in Mexico.
So I definitely want to come back to that because the two things are so intimately linked. But if we could now, I mean, Professor Garcia, I keep thinking of the story you told of Cece, right, who arrived kidnapped, rolled up in a rug. What happens to someone like that on day one, once they arrive at the Anexo?
On day one, Cece sat against a wall and cried the entire afternoon. And I spent the afternoon seated beside her, not talking, but just trying to lend some moral support. She actually didn't really appreciate my presence that much, but she was really hardened and obviously very, very distraught. And but what happened that day specifically was Cece was allowed to sort of sit where she was for the day. The Anexados assembled and did what they called study hour, which was actually reading passages from the Bible. So Cece was around for that. Then there was a meal time. Cece was around for that. And eventually it was nighttime, bedtime. And Cece took her place on the floor next to all of the other Anexados. You typically sleep on thick blankets. And she took her place on her thick blanket. And then in the morning, woke up at 5 a.m. The day starts with exercise, then moves to a very simple breakfast. It's very regimented. Mm-hmm. There's a very tight schedule that people follow. And Cece just got folded into the lot and just started following the schedule like everybody else. But it did take her a few days to stop crying and to sort of settle down and recognize where she was. She had been there before. People knew her when she arrived. So there were already relationships that she had with folks there, including with the counselors and the padrino. So she wasn't unfamiliar with this space. She just didn't think she would ever end up back in it. And she did.
I'm so fascinated by what you said about how regimented they are, right? I mean, because you reveal in the book, it's to a degree where even people who are there, there's a lot of focus on how they're holding their bodies, if they're holding their bodies correctly, and the tight scheduling, as you said. There's no medication given, as far as I could tell from your book, but there's a lot of time spent in meetings. Now, you had mentioned the Bible before, and in your research, you write about how in these meetings, it's often like people giving testimony for hours and hours and hours. I mean, how much is religion actually a foundation to this or woven into the kind of treatment that one would get at an Anexo?
Religion is definitely woven into this. And I would say this is a form of, these are mostly Catholic communities. They're not Pentecostal, they're Catholic. And they're deeply Catholic in many ways. You walk into one of these spaces, there's a cross, there are Bibles, there are rosaries, et cetera. But they're, and there's a podium where people, the anexados, are forced to go and give what is called testimony. But what is also in other anexos that I studied, often called confessions. And they're forced to do this for hours every day. This is the primary activity. And one anexado will go up. They'll be forced to speak for, you know, sometimes 3-4 hours or more. Then they take their seat and another anexado goes up. They tell their story. And that rhythm of testimony is really kind of what maintains the anexo throughout the day.
Yeah.
I mean, you just hear testimony after testimony after testimony. And the stories that I began recording were real stories of loss. They were stories of of having been witness to violence, having been a perpetrator of violence, but also a victim of violence. So the stories that the anexados told, and many of them were quite young, in their 20s and sometimes teenagers, but not always. Often they were older, in their 50s and sometimes even 60s and 70s. They would, you know, weave in elements of their own life into these stories of addiction and violence. And so I began to be able to paint a sort of broader picture, not only of the individual, but like what life was like for them outside of the anexo.
We'll come back to that, because again, that the violence part of this is so important. But, you know, as I hear you describe the testimonies and the fact that no medication is given, that it seems like there's some kind of 12-step inflected methodology going on here. I mean, these are all things that I imagine a lot of listeners might think, well, roll their eyes or be concerned at, because they're probably wondering where's the evidence base for it. But I'm actually wondering the opposite. Given the importance of Catholicism, as you said, in particular to the places where these anexos are, to the families that feel they have no other resort or no other option other to send their loved ones to them, I mean, is it possible that through religion and through the ways of being in Catholicism, that perhaps there's some kind of at least powerful touch point for the people who are being treated there?
Absolutely. And it's, you know, for me, the powerful touch point wasn't just about religion or, you know, what emerges through certain kind of ritual practices, which were, you know, often quite beautiful, even though, you know, anexados were forced to do them. Well, that wasn't so different as what it was like for me when I was, you know, going to Catholic school. At one point, and I was forced to do certain rituals as well. But, you know, but there is a, you know, these are coercive practices, even if they are infused with a kind of Catholic sensibility. Nevertheless, they are, the anexados are forced to do certain kinds of religious practices. But what I felt like a lot of these practices, whether it was reading from the Bible, whether it was sitting on your knees for hours and having to pray or be silent, there was a desire to sort of change the inner workings of the self, for anexados to become very aware of their own bodies, very aware of physical pain, because a lot of the people who enter into these spaces have experienced lifetimes of pain, but have felt that they've actually become numb to the pain itself. And so one of the sort of philosophies is to bring pain back into the body, into the minds of the people who have been experiencing it, you know, often for much of their lives. And so when one is going through this experience of pain, whether that's through the body or through testimony, where how it emerges, it's something that is witnessed. And I think it's the element of witnessing that is so crucial to anexos, because so many people experience pain alone. And in this context, you experience it in front of your peers, with your peers, and there's a kind of community that emerges from this shared pain.
But how do you draw the line between the potential healing impact of either experiencing or expressing pain and the witnessing thereof, and abuse.
That is the line that has always captured my attention. It's always fascinated me, and it fascinated me when I worked in a detox clinic in the United States. All of the patients there were court appointed. So in a sense, they too were coerced into treatment. And I often wondered, does being coerced into treatment work? Or does there have to be a degree of, you know, self-decision, like, I want to be here? And, you know, in this context, what works in an exos isn't just that you cannot use, there's no alcohol, there are no drugs that I ever witnessed. But it's also a matter of, you know, being with others, being forced to participate in the same kind of daily activity. Yes, these were coercive spaces. There was often things that certainly I believed were abusive, forms of psychological and physical abuse. But there was also some, and that existed. I don't want to downplay that did not exist, but it existed alongside the development of friendships, of community, sometimes of romances, and of people beginning to imagine a different kind of life for themselves, the possibility of starting one's own annexos as being there was like also the sort of entrepreneurial spirit that was often generated through one's being an annexo, though they think, okay, I want to become a counselor. Okay, I want to become, you know, a padrino. And that actually mirrors very closely to who becomes a drug counselor in this country. Mm. Who, you know, they are often recovering drug users themselves. And so it in many ways mirrors some of the kind of resource poor clinics that I've witnessed and worked in the United States.
I guess the big question is, do they work, though, right? Because, right. I mean, in the United States, as you well know, over the past several decades, there's been this kind of evolution in thinking about substance abuse, right? Moving towards a more a model where it's considered a disorder, right? On a public health issue. And by virtue of it being a disorder, perhaps sometimes people suffering from substance abuse need medication or long-term treatment or whatnot. But tough love isn't necessarily so much favored anymore by people who advise on substance abuse issues, because the belief is that's not as effective as other ways of doing it. So, I mean, how much have you been able to judge or gauge if the treatment received in an annexo works?
Well, one of the things that I found, and this was what was really surprising to me, is that a lot of people that are in annexos don't identify as having a problem with addiction. They're not, you know, a lot of them, young people, yes, I use drugs, you know, and they would describe to me the types of drugs they would use, or people who have problems with alcohol would describe that. But often the problem, and this became increasingly apparent to me over time, the problem was really violence.
Yes.
And so in the sense that annexos remove people from neighborhoods that are very insecure and put them in a space that is also very insecure, but nevertheless where they are held, mothers in particular saw them as working. They worked because they knew where their kids were. They knew they were eating. They knew they had a place to sleep. They knew they wouldn't get out and be able to kind of roam at their own peril. And for mothers, they worked because it gave them a little bit of peace of mind. So it kind of depends on what are we asking, whether it works to stop people from using drugs. Well, certainly in the short term, it does. When you're there, you're not using. But it also works for the people that are outside, for the mother, in particular, the mothers who can rest a little bit easier knowing that their kid is in such a place, even though they know the risks of what that might mean to be in this place, because they know what goes on.
But then also both of these benefits, though, in terms of peace of mind for family and temporary sobriety, they're time limited, right? I mean, do the people go back to the very same neighborhoods that are so infected with violence, or do they end up falling back into substance abuse again?
They're limited in basically people stay in there as long as someone is paying for them mm-hmm. to stay in there. So it's a small, relatively small monthly fee compared to what another addiction treatment center would be. And, you know, women in particular, they're often left with a burden of taking care of addicted kids. And they themselves then have to work that much harder to keep their kids in an EXOS, so in order to meet the monthly fee. So they're taking on additional work to keep them in. And a lot of women would say to me, I would not be taking on this work if I did not believe something good were happening, because I work all the time. I wouldn't want to work even more.
Well, Professor Garcia, hang on for just a moment. There's so much more to discuss about what you've revealed in your research about an EXOS, including a little bit later in the show, I want to talk about what you've discovered here in the United States as well. So a lot more in just a moment. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're going to get back to today's conversation about an EXOS in Mexico in just a moment. But first, I wanted to give you guys a little quick preview about something that's coming up later this week. We are going to be talking to celebrated author Amy Tan about her new book. It's called The Backyard Bird Chronicles. It's not only written by Amy Tan, but it's spectacularly illustrated by her as well. The cover just has, for example, I'm looking at the cover right now, has four beautiful bird illustrations that that Amy Tan made. And it's even got a foreword by David Allen Sibley. So wait, was that birders I heard across America going squee? Yes, it's going to be an amazing hour. So we want your help, though. We want to hear from you about what you see, the birds you look for, what you see, hear, feel, experience on your bird walks. So here's what I'd love you to do. Get your phone, your smartphone, get the On Point Vox Pop app. If you don't already have it, just go to wherever you get your apps and look for On Point Vox Pop and take it along with you on your next bird walk. Hopefully that's today or tomorrow. And talk to us about what you're seeing, what you're hearing, how you're feeling and during the walk and why you love birding so much. So again, do that over the On Point Vox Pop app or give us a call at 617-353-0683. That's for a little bit later this week. Today, we are speaking with Stanford Professor of Anthropology Angela Garcia about her new book, The Way That Leads Among the Lost, Life, Death, and Hope in Mexico City's an EXOS. And Professor Garcia, just for a moment, I hope you don't mind, but I want to sort of apply a much more skeptical filter here to some of my questions. Because while I don't deny that these an EXOS are mushrooming across Mexico, because there's a vast unmet need due both to drugs and violence associated with the drug war that you've talked about several times, I have to wonder, I mean, you say they don't cost very much, but I'm curious about how much they cost. Who's running them? Is there some kind of organized network that started the EXOS and is growing them? Is this kind of is it possible to see this as mothers, especially as you're saying, getting bilked by folks offering them a bit of hope, but maybe not much long-term peace regarding the ways drugs and violence have affected their families? Like, is there a sort of a more underlying organization here that we need to talk about?
Yeah, that's certainly something that I was very concerned and interested in when I started this work. And, you know, it's important to note that a lot of these EXOS are situated within apartment complexes. So a lot of the people that find themselves in the EXO They may be from that apartment complex where people have lived their entire lives. Sometimes generations of people have lived in their entire lives. And so these places are often known to the people within the building. Mm-hmm. They're known to be almost, you know, it's a combination of a kind of both a sort of tough love, detox clinic, AA space, and shelter. So the Annexo is a kind of a fusion of all of these different kinds of activities, different kinds of needs. And again, they're situated typically within a domestic sphere. And so, you know, women are bringing food to keep people eating. Sometimes they'll wash the laundry in exchange for help with a child that is, you know, struggling with addiction problems. But most people will pay a monthly fee of anywhere between typically around $30 to $50 a month, mm-hmm. to keep a child or a spouse, a loved one in one of these spaces. And it's not like you just drop them off and then you don't engage with them anymore. Although that was certainly the experience of a few Annexados who I met. But for the most part, you know, there are visiting hours once a week. And if you're in good standing, you're able to go sit in the communal courtyard with a family member and talk, and then you are led back into the Annexo. So, I mean, they are in some ways carceral spaces, but again, they're situated within neighborhoods, they're situated within apartment complexes, in full view of other families who are, you know, conducting their daily mm-hmm. lives. People know that apartment 2A is in an Annexo, and they know that if they need help, they could send someone there. And you know, if they themselves are at risk, and this is something I saw too, for example, a woman who was suffering from domestic violence, and everyone knew, so the padrino took her husband out, threw him into the Annexo for a few days just to cool things off at home, and then he would go back, and the padrino would check in on the woman to make sure she was okay. So they serve a lot of different purposes. Addiction is but one of them, mm-hmm. and but it's a big one, because the problem of addiction is worsening in Mexico. Many of the drugs that are meant for the consumption in the U.S. are finding their way into domestic markets, and so addiction is definitely a concern. But there are other concerns that the Annexo. Yeah. Deals with as well.
So I guess to put it more bluntly, did you find any evidence or feel any need for concern that people were profiteering off the suffering of others?
That was definitely a worry that I had. And, you know, I was at one party once in one of these buildings where there were apartment buildings where there was an Annexo. And a woman said to me, "Oh, have you met the padrinos of the Annexo that's in our building?" I said, "No, I hadn't." And she said, "Well, just look for the guy who has the fanciest clothes on," indicating, you know, people are making some money here. And, you know, that is always a concern. And it was one that I carried with me and still do, because I'm still in contact with a number of people in Annexos and who are in them and who run them. But these are mostly loose networks of people that were in AA for decades, who Annexos actually emerged from an offshoot of AA that was very popular in Mexico City. So that AA really is the roots of these spaces. And so there are networks of Annexos. There are certain Annexos that have a particular kind of philosophy that is one of service. There's another, you know, another stream of Annexos where the philosophy is one more of like physical discipline. So there are different sort of philosophies at work. The ones that I followed were the ones that generally saw themselves more closely aligned with AA, mm-hmm. and were what you might call Annexos light. They were certainly not as overtly violent as others that I was told about. I personally wanted to stay out of those spaces for concerns of my own safety and also the safety of others. But so the ones that I went to were, you know, again, I just want to emphasize the the connection of these spaces to a broader neighborhood environment. Mm-hmm. They're not hidden. They're not, in the sense that they've often been described as being quote unquote underground. They're illegal, but they're not underground.
Yeah.
Everyone knows they exist, and they know they might be two doors down, you know, in the other apartment, just down the, you know, down the hallway, for example.
Well, so I want to get back then to how you've mentioned oftentimes that the scale of the problem that the Anexos are springing up to try and meet would not have been so large were it not for the rising violence in Mexico, due to heavily in part due to the drug trade, right? To the gangs, the narco traffickers, the cartels. You know, many of the stories that we hear in the United States about how Mexicans are suffering from the drug trade have to do with kidnappings and murders, right? Would you say that this, you know, what we're discussing in terms of neighborhood violence, addiction, families just being constantly afraid, young people having their lives derailed, is that's another major part of the cost of the drug trade between Mexico and the United States that just isn't often that, you know, that much discussed?
Yeah. And another aspect of Anexos is that many of the people in them are actually suffering from mental health issues. Mm. And if we think about what wars do to people's mental health, you know, I saw people in there that might be classified as having PTSD or you know, terrible problems with anxiety, depression. So in addition to dealing with addiction, there were people there that were really suffering from mental health disorders who didn't identify as having a drug problem at all. And oftentimes family members who couldn't deal with the gravity of the sort of emotional and mental health problems that their relatives were facing, would turn to Anexos as well for, you know, support. So the places also held people who identified as having PTSD or anxiety, or what is sometimes called more broadly in Mexico some form of neuroses. That's a term that's still very much in use there, and so they really. They become a lens, I think, from which to see a whole host of problems, you know, drug violence, addiction, mental illness, and also just the needs of women needing support with their loved ones, women often needing a break from their loved ones, yeah. who are, you know, suffering from these problems. So they serve a host of things, and they become sort of microcosms from which to really begin to understand all of the issues that are confronting these sort of low-income, marginalized communities who don't have access to professional health resources. Mm-hmm.
So we're headed towards, unfortunately, the last several minutes of the show, Professor Garcia. I've got a couple more questions for you. And first of all, I'd just love for you to tell us or describe to us what happened to Ceci.
Well, she got out, and I went once. Her family owns a small stationery shop in this working class neighborhood where the Anexo was located, and she went back, and she's working with her mother in the stationery shop. But it's not, you know, it's a rocky road for her, mm-hmm. Her mother, you know, told me without doubt. If Ceci feels like she's again at risk, her mother is going to send her back to the very place where, you know, mm-hmm. she had been released from and back into the care of her family. So last I knew, she was back at work with her mom in their little stationery shop and was doing fairly well. Did the Anexo help? I think it did to a certain extent. It helped her family. It you know, she developed strong friendships with some of the people that were there. She was off the streets. She was forced to, you know, kick her use of drugs. But whether or not Ceci will be out long term is something that, you know, is unknown mm-hmm. to me. And, you know, my job as an anthropologist is to try to continue to follow these people to get a sense of, you know, what happens to them once they're released.
So I understand that you have found a couple Anexos in the Bay Area.
Yes.
Can you tell me a little bit about that? Yeah.
Many. Well, I came to understand that there were Anexos in the U.S. when I would be interviewing anexados in Mexico City, and they would say, oh, my first time in an anexo was in El Paso or in LA or in, you know, Redwood City. And so I became interested in what got these things exist in the U.S. I got a team of researchers together, and we began charting them in the Bay Area and found 23 of them without a lot of digging. You know, once you find one, you ask, hey, are there any others? And then they say, yes, there's one here. And then, you know, you're just led. There's just this network. And the annexo, and there are many, many. And I describe in the book one annexo in Oakland, California, that is run by and for women. And the women there were all undocumented. Many of them suffered from mental health problems, some from addiction problems as well. But the annexo in Oakland for women was really in some ways served not just as a detox space, but a space of refuge. And the women that, you know, I would listen to their testimonies there, the kinds of concerns that they described were very, very different. They were worried about loved ones back home who were living in war-torn towns in Michoacan, Guerrero, you know, all over throughout Mexico. They were worried about being deported. They were worried about being able to feed their children. You know, so the kinds of anxieties and concerns that anexadas or anexados in this country have are to a certain degree rather different from the ones that I encountered in Mexico City.
So I guess finally, while the annexos are there, because as I've mentioned several times, clearly they're serving a very, very urgent need. Ultimately, we would love to live in a world where the need wasn't so great, right? And, you know, given the complexity of the illegal drug trade, of the relationship between that and violence, of failed policies over many decades in the United States and Mexico about the, you know, the cycle of violence and illegal drugs that continues to ramp up, I'm wondering, you know, based on your research and what you've observed, is there anything specific that you would like to see changed that perhaps would then maybe ease the need for so many annexos in Mexico?
I mean, ultimately, I would like to see real, you know, a different form of drug policy, one that prioritizes addiction treatment and not punishment. And I think that is something that, you know, would benefit Mexico as well. But the annexos, I think their proliferation, both in Mexico and in the U.S., speaks to broad questions of violence. What is the United States' role in the intensification of violence in Mexico? That's one of the things that the book really tries to point out. These places exist in part because of our own policies, and because of our own hunger and thirst, you know, and need for drugs. So there needs to be a kind of binational discussion. There's binational discussion, but one that takes into account the needs of people who are suffering from addiction in Mexico as well. And a form of policy and a form of analysis and reckoning that sees addiction not just a problem with drugs per se, but a problem that, you know, is composed of so many, you know, different elements.
Yeah. Well, the book is The Way That Leads Among the Lost: Life, Death, and Hope in Mexico City's Annexos. It's by Angela Garcia, professor of anthropology at Stanford University. Professor Garcia, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.